So, good Lord. So, good morning. I'll just barely whisper and maybe it'll all work out for everyone. The HASI instrument flew 2 days ago, July 11th of last year, so basically a year ago. And I'm going to tell you all about this payload, really from the point of view of some of the first results we've had about magnetic energy storage and release in the corona. Flew on a black Brant. Probably Adrian has already told you all about these things. And we picked it up on the moon. You can see a picture of it down there. These things are a lot of fun. So I don't need any competition on these rocket flights, that they're hard to come by, but they're a lot of fun if you ever get to do them. So it's not without a lot of irony, I think, that I get about as long as a rocket flight to tell you about my rocket flight, because they last about 15 minutes and you get about 300 seconds worth of data. HASI basically is a channel similar to one on the AIA on SDO. It's the 193 angstrom channel, which is dominated by an iron 12 line. The difference in HASI relative to AIA is the real increase in effective area. So we, in addition to having a lot of effective area, we've got a longer focal length, 23.9 meter effective focal length, which gives us a spatial resolution on the order of 2/10 arc second. And with this increase in effective area, we can take very short exposures. So on July 11th of last year, there was this active region near disk center, and that box shows you the HASI field of view, and the image on the right is the initial HASI full frame image. We have a 4K by 4K CCD, and we took basically 30 full resolution images at 2 second exposures with a 5 second cadence. So this is about a factor of 5, both in spatial resolution and in temporal resolution over AIA. And that's really important. The increase both in time and spatial resolution is really what allowed us to do some of the really fantastic science that we're just now getting started on. We took a bunch of 1K by 1K data. There's a great anecdotal story I'll tell you about changing your field of view in the middle of a rocket flight, and I'm not going to do that right now. So I'm going to basically talk to you about 3 different papers that have been published on the data, and they all revolve around what we feel is evidence of nanoflare heating in the corona. Jim, calm down. So really what we think that HASI has demonstrated is that the magnetic field in the corona is storing up energy, and at all sorts of different spatial scales, we're seeing this energy be released, and there are all these different observations that are evidence of that. In this particular instance, which was in my paper in January of this year, what we believe that we see is the convergence of some magnetic field to a point. At that X point, a small flare happens. There's a nice spine of positive magnetic polarity down at the sun's surface, and we have the contours of these field lines over that. And you can see all these different channels from AIA 304, 171, the two HASI images. This is just a mask of this image. And then the AIA, well, this is the HASI image, and this is the AIA image, and then AIA 94 angstroms. So the movie here shows you the HASI data for about a minute and a half or so, and then after the HASI data stops, well, after, it's not going to continue to run. At the end of the HASI flight, just a couple of minutes later, there's a little C flare that goes off. So it's at this crossing that we have the little arrow. At this crossing, the little flare happens. So it's interesting to note that in the AIA data, if you just took this cross section, it'd only be, you know, a structure or so across, but AIA actually, or HASI actually shows you that there's lots of different little strands that make up this structure, and those strands, you can actually watch them during the flight. They actually cross over one another, and then at the end of the observation at this little X point, there goes from 2 or 3 of them to just a single, and then the flare goes off. So nice anecdotal indirect evidence of a reconnection event. Well, Amy went and took it a step further. There was ICE data. This is data collected from the ICE instrument on anode A. And the ICE data can be used to verify temperature and density
get us some idea of whether the filling factor from the ICE data, using approaches like Harry and David Brooks have come up with, use this ICE data to see if the density and filling factor indicate that we're actually resolving the structure in HAC, what the density might be, get some idea about energy release using that. And using those types of techniques, she found temperatures about 1.8 megakelvin, density on the order of 10 to 10 parts per cubic centimeter. And from the HAC data, we get a structure about 435 kilometers. You take all this together, and you get a density roughly the same when you use this information in the HAC intensity to infer a density from the instrument response and whatever else. So the two things are of the same order. And what we basically concluded is something that David Brooks verified in a different article, is that we are resolving these structures. They're of the order 200 kilometers to 700 kilometers across. So they're below the resolution of AIA and other instruments. So we're above the resolution of HAC. So they're within the range that we feel like we're actually resolving things fundamentally. A different example, in the article we call this braided loop, but what it looks like to us is a structure that resembles a French braid. That's braided loop idea. More to the point, it resembles the Parker braiding concept for energy storage in the corona. And what we did in this paper was we watched this structure, this braided loop, evolve as a function of time. We measured flows in this box area, came up with numbers for energy storage and energy release associated with the structure. So just a close-up of this version of this movie with HAC, you can see this braided loop structure, and the masking, unsharp mask, gives you a better sense for how wrapped this particular structure is. So these are the AIA channels, and we can watch the thing over the course of a whole day. That's the whole point of launching AIA. You get to see the whole sun all the time. This structure lights up and fades away, lights up and fades away multiple different times. One such heating or intensity increase happened just before the HAC launch are bounded by these dashed lines, and you can see dropping back off, and then later in the day it goes back up. It ends up doing this multiple times. From the radiated information in the AIA passbands or ice or whatever else, you can get a sense for the total amount of radiated power. Going through the calculations on that, you end up with the total radiated power being about 10 to the 26 ergs per second. If you go back to the HAC data and get information about the magnetic field at the photosphere, and you run the math on that, you can come up with a number for B theta, so the inclined magnetic field and the volume as measured from the HAC data. Throw that into this equation, you end up with the amount of energy being stored in that structure of something like 10 to the 29 ergs, so more than enough power in this structure to radiate that amount of power away. It's doing it over the course of the day, and it ends up that structure faded away about 18 hours later. So a fairly long-lived structure, not something where it was just an energetic burst of that magnetic energy release, but it was a leaking power or leaking energy, not just throwing it off in one big burst. In a different area, Palatessa and Bart and others looked at energy release associated with these long, hot loops. And in their paper, in this particular region, there's a bright patch of moss at about a million change Kelvin. And at that particular location, they went and measured the variability in these X-ray bright points the EUV bright points that HAC was able to observe. You can see the difference in resolution between the HAC and the AIA data. Even with a crummy projector, you can get a sense that the spatial resolution for HAC is much better than the AIA. So these highly variable patches and these little pluses, you can see them come and go. And I would tell you to read the paper if you wanted more detail. But the point being is these very transient events are changing on a time scale of about 15 seconds with an increase of 20 to 30% following a coronal loop brightening. So not like spicules in the chromosphere and then a subsequent increase in intensity in coronal lines, but in this instance, an increase in the intensity in a coronal line followed by an increase in intensity in the chromosphere in the moss. So what does that really mean? I'm not going to postulate that for you today, but it is suggestive of a footpoint response to something going on in the corona. So that's a very interesting result for us as well. So, unfortunately, sequestration prevented all of my colleagues from coming and telling you about all their different interesting results. But I will say that I think, my opinion is, that for the first time, HAC is revealing that magnetic braiding and magnetic interaction component reconnection is occurring, and this is consistent with AC heating models. It doesn't seem like AIA or HiC is giving us a lot of information on wave heating mechanisms, but you know, four or five papers have been published on AC heating mechanisms and observations. So we're seeing this evidence of reconnection and heating in several different regions, in moss and in this braided loop and in the little flaring X-point loop. Another paper was just published recently on a different moss location and a different heating profile from that one. We're seeing ranges in temperatures for these things being heated somewhere between 0.3 megakelvin and 8 million degrees. So very interesting, the ranges and energies being deposited for the different locations that we're observing. And I guess lastly, I would say that surprisingly, many of these first results highlight the transient nature of the corona. And so we've been observing the full sun or active regions with trace and EIT at 20 and 30 second cadence and one arc second resolution for about 25 years. But you go to a 2/10 arc second resolution, you go to 5 second cadence, and you get a whole brand new suite of results associated with energy release and storage. I think it really is a peek into the future of what we're going to be able to do with higher resolution observations, particularly in the extreme ultraviolet, where we can make these types of instruments. So we're seeing these things for both large hot loops, like in Testa's paper, and these low-lying dense coronal loops. Amy has written a paper on those. And they all seem to be consistent with these nanoflare heating models. So my last slide, and I'll stop here. We've made all this data available through the VSO. You can go to this URL. It's all provided through the Virtual Solar Observatory. And our team has worked very hard to have the same sort of data analysis resources and software routines made available by larger missions like SDO. So you can go and collect all those routines up here. And the last thing would be a plug. We think that the science capacity for HiC, especially conjoined with instruments like IRIS, really warrant another flight. Maybe we're not going to push the technological boundaries anymore. We've proven that we can launch a high-resolution telescope on a sounding rocket with 17 Gs and all that kind of stuff. But a flight like this, at 2/10 arc second, seeing what the coronal response for mass flow from the chromosphere or from reconnection events in the corona really can do a lot, even in 300 seconds. And with sequestration and other budgetary limitations for us launching big missions to do this in the future, I think a HiC reflight is in order. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Jonathan. Questions? Hugh.
Congratulations on what must have been a really thrilling flight. So the question is, what resolution did you actually achieve? And second, how did you measure it? And third, is it worthwhile to consider even higher resolution?
Well, Craig DeForest would tell you that the Fourier spectrum power would put us somewhere on 0.28, 0.3 arc seconds resolution. So you can measure that by lots of different points. You can do the Fourier transform. You can see what the power is and where the noise floor picks up. That's how that was measured. There are other ways that we can do that. We can compare structures and all of that kind of thing. The filling factor is a different approach. The filling factor from the ICE data and the densities imply something on the order of a filling factor of 0.1 from the ICE data, which is right around our spatial scale, you know, assuming we match the plate scale. And our filling factor is right around 1. So that's indirect evidence. I would say that clearly we're around 0.3, 0.25, 0.3 arc seconds resolution. The last question, should we go to higher resolution? A lot of our results indicate that we're resolving structures. You know, there are a lot of things in the 400 to 800 kilometer resolution. But the data from SOT, the NFI broadband data at truly 0.1 resolution, shows structures even below that. So, you know, I don't think it would require a whole lot of effort to go to a 40 meter effective focal length, but in a sounding rocket, that's a 12x magnification secondary mirror, and the tolerance on the interoptic spacing probably